Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. My next guest is Craig Randall. Craig received his bachelor's degree from English from the University of Washington, his master's in education in guidance and counseling from St. Martin's University, and his principal certification from Western Washington University. Craig has worked as an elementary and middle school counselor, including one intense year in the classroom with students with severe behavior issues. In addition, he has served as an academic advisor at the college level. He has worked as a collegiate basketball coach. He has worked as a teacher at the elementary, middle, and high school levels, as well as in college. Craig has worked in the job of his passion and calling, assistant principal and principal as well. Craig has done his work at schools in both the U.S. and overseas. Now, as the author of the book and founder of the business with the same name, Trust-Based Observations, Craig's goal is to transform the world of teacher observation and evaluation. He is dedicated to training and supporting, consulting with school leaders on the use of trust-based observations, empowering them to build supportive relationships with their teachers, relationships with which foster risk-taking, which in turn dramatically improve teaching and learning. Currently, Craig lives in rainy but beautiful Pacific Northwest with the best educator he knows, his wife and new teacher mentor, Michelle, and they're just graduated high school twins, Celia and Craigo. Welcome to the podcast, Craig.
It's Acalia, but thanks so much. Yeah, I'm really happy to be on the show.
Well, thanks so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast. I really took a lot of interest in just this concept of trust-based observations, and we'll get to that during our conversation. But as I start out with everybody, tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
Yeah, well, I think the best examples are always the ones where we make mistakes and learn from them. And so I'll share one of those. So I was working as a school principal, and we had a model with our English language learner teachers that they did push in and they co-taught. And so I would just periodically do check-ins just to make sure everyone is where they're supposed to be. And I discovered that one of my teachers was not pushing in, or I couldn't find her pushing in very frequently. It seemed to be a matter of maybe she was just pushing in with more teachers that were her friends than other teachers. And so I just happened to be talking to another ELL teacher who was an office mate of this teacher. And she was talking to me about how difficult it was to push into classes and do her planning, especially we had a block schedule where some days were tougher than others. And I said, oh, are there other teachers having the same problem? And she just had this sort of pained expression on her face that really told me everything. And then I said, well, what's going on? And she said, well, I was explaining the same issue about struggling to get into my classes with my office mate. And she said, oh, that's just a guideline. You don't really have to get into everyone. And she's like, well, no, I have to, that's my job. And she's like, no, it's okay. It's just, you just get to the ones you can. And she's like, no, I can't. And she said, oh, you mean morals. No, it's okay. Mm-hmm. And so that was a tough story to hear. And it was tough for that teacher to share because she put herself in a pretty vulnerable position. And so I went after school sometime in the next week or so to go have a conversation with that teacher about pushing in and just so we could fix it and move forward. And so I just basically told her that I'd been checking and had noticed she hadn't been in doing some of her observation or being in classes, co-teaching, pushing in. And she said, no, I've been to every single one. I always go to my things. And I was just saying, you know, I haven't seen you. And she said, well, you must not have been there the entire class period because I'm there at least some of the class period. Mm-hmm. And I just said, I know that's not true. But then I was just shocked that she had literally lied to me, not told me the truth. And so I reacted not ideally. And my voice raised and the anger was evident in my voice. And I expressed that I knew that wasn't the truth. And she got defensive. And then somehow I got myself more calm. And I said, okay, well, you know what? I think I'm going to leave right now. Mm-hmm. And I did. And Then we scheduled another meeting for a few days down the road. And basically I decided that after consulting with my head of school, that as long as she admitted that she'd made a mistake, and I would give her every opportunity to have an understandable, acceptable reason for why that wouldn't have, why that might've happened, that I'd be willing to work with her. Mm-hmm. And so called her into my office, and she was involved in a lot of like student council and extracurricular and play things. And so I threw, you know, maybe one time Nat took your time and couldn't do it. Maybe you were feeling under the weather. I just kept throwing her all these things. We're like, just take one, take, mm-hmm. take this life preserver. And she wouldn't grab it. She just kept denying and denying and denying. And at that point, I just realized I couldn't, and we were in a place where it was year-to-year contracts. I couldn't work comfortably with someone that wouldn't be truthful about something so simple. And so I let her go at the end of the year. And I mean, I let her know that we weren't going to renew her contract. And then somewhere, I don't know, about May, Human Resources, and this was a larger company, not just one school, and Human Resources came to me saying that she'd filed a grievance about the way that I had treated her mm-hmm. in that first meeting. And, you know, we dealt with it, and I explained everything that happened, and the grievance went away, and it wasn't a problem. But one of the things that I learned from that, and I write about it in the book, is like whenever we have a difficult or anything that could potentially be a difficult conversation, is that it's really, really important to think about what are a potential negative answer that a teacher could provide that you're not expecting, and then prepare an answer to that ahead of time. And if you spend a little bit of time, 10, 15 minutes thinking about that, then you're not caught off guard, and then you can react where you can maintain your emotional even keel to help things move forward constructively. And so that's my story.
Yeah, no, that, you know, I think is quite a lesson for assistant principals and principals that have either been in a similar situation, or, you know, to imagine, you know, if they're walking into a difficult situation, it doesn't hurt to role play maybe with somebody, you know, that's maybe not attached to the situation, or, you know, envision for yourself answers that the teacher might have, right? So you kind of know what to expect based on your knowledge of the person's personality. So, you know, I think, you know, that you know, you gain that
perspective. If not, like, just in case. I mean, you have people where you know you're, go ahead.
No, you gain that perspective, you know, through years of experience working with teachers and evaluations and, like you said, it's kind of individual as to how people react, but yeah, that's not a story that's you know, that's only happened to one principal, right? It's happened, I'm sure, to several around. So
some variant of that, absolutely.
Yeah. So your book was just published this year, Trust-Based Observations: Maximizing Teachers and Teaching and Learning Growth. And walk me through just the process of wanting to write this book, and why you see it's a need, especially today, this year, with all the sorts of learning models that we have. Why principals need trust-based to implement trust-based observations now?
Sure. Well, I mean, I guess explaining why it's maybe a need is to look at the current model first. And so, you know, the current model where there's one or two observations per year, and there's a pre-conference where we talk about what's going to be taught, and then we go and observe, and then we rate the teachers on these quite lengthy rubrics of all these indicators of good teaching. And then we have a post-observation conference where we tell the teachers how they did, hopefully highlight some strengths, and then talk about what they can do to improve. And so that's the standard model. And so the research is really the big key in a lot of ways, because the research is that it doesn't improve teaching and learning. And the most clear example of that is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation did a 7-year, $200 million study, basically where their goal was to improve the quality of teaching. They improved the quality of student learning outcomes and graduation rates through basically what amounted to a more robust evaluation observation process. and 7 years, $200 million. And the research basically said that there was no sustained improvement. And then if you add on top of that, a man named Matt O'Leary, who to my mind is the predominant researcher in observation and evaluation in the world, has done a bunch of qualitative research on observations and evaluations. And what he has discovered is that as soon as we start to evaluatively rate teachers, they start playing it safe. And therefore we lose creativity and innovation in teaching. And so those are the reasons it's not working. And so for me, the start of it really was my own frustration with having a 2-year period where I wasn't observed at all and just feeling like, what is going on here? And then even with the standard observation, when it was done well, just feeling like it wasn't enough and wasn't accurate. And I started around the same time my principal certification program and came across my mentor. And I remember the first class that I had with him was a supervision class. And he just started talking about, you have to be in classes all the time. You have to be in classes every day, mm-hmm. observing teachers, having reflective questions with teachers, supporting them and helping them grow. And I remember asking him, well, how long? And I think like a lot of people that are really naturally gifted at something, he never really thought about it. He was just doing it all the time. And then he finally said an hour a day. And then that became really the first part of trust-based observations is we do 3 20-minute observations a day. And then we would practice doing observations all the time in that class. We'd put on little 10-minute mini lessons, and then we would then one of us would observe, and then we'd immediately practice the reflective conversation and then have a reflective conversation on the reflective conversation. And it was really, really powerful. And those conversations were anchored by two questions that still drive trust observations today. And they were, what were you doing to help students learn? And if you had it to do over again, what, if anything, might you do differently? Mm-hmm. And so without knowing it, I certainly didn't know I was creating anything new. That was the start of it. And then when I became an assistant principal shortly thereafter, I started doing it. And then at the beginning of the reflective conversation, after those questions, I was a little reluctant to give feedback. And I think it was partially because I was a new guy and wanted to be liked. And I think it was partially because I'd only seen them once or twice, and to offer suggestions already felt like it was almost arrogant of me to, mm-hmm. to start telling them. So what I started doing instead was I just started sharing what I observed and noticed, which is really noticing the strengths. Mm-hmm. And teachers responded so well to that. Many of them had said they hadn't even had anybody really do that before, I think because the traditional model didn't really call for that. And then what was even more remarkable to me was that shortly thereafter that, many teachers started saying, okay, but what can I get better at? And then without really realizing it then, that was probably the start of the trust observations piece. And so it just kept developing from there on and on and on to what it is today. And at some point along the way, somebody said, you ought to protect your stuff. And I didn't know what he was talking about. And he's like, wow, this is really good. And I was like, really? And then I presented at a conference and that went really well. And I wrote an article and then I wrote a book. So that's how that really came to be. But if we talk about how we need it today, there's no question for everybody, principals, students, teachers, this is incredibly challenging and much harder than it has been in the past. And so with that comes feelings of vulnerability and struggle and not knowing what to do and not necessarily having answers. And if we look at research, it really points out that when people trust, they're more willing to take risks. And if there was ever a time when we wanted teachers to be willing to try new things to see what works and doesn't work, it's now. And so if we can create differentiated, individualized, trusting relationships with teachers, they will be more willing to take risks. One of the things that we always say to our teachers as part of trust-based observations, because risk-taking is such a vital element in growth, is that if I come into your classroom and you're trying something new, and it completely bombs, you can rest assured that the next day you're going to receive a congratulatory fist bump for taking risks, because we know eventually that will lead to growth. And boy, if there was ever a time for that, now would be that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really think that this was the time we needed a wake up call, because different states use different things. Some people use a Danielson framework, some people use state evaluation tools. Some people just have the evaluation tool that their own district has made, but it's always just been that checklist, right? And having taught for many years and then moving into administration, I always felt like, you know, it was just kind of a duty they had to do, right? They got in your classroom twice a year. They checked off the list. You really yep. didn't get much feedback. And as you're saying, you know, you even started discovering this already during your principal licensure program, which I found interesting. Is
yeah,
doing those
I'm so
practice,
lucky to meet that man. Yeah.
Yeah. Practice feedback, practice mini lessons, and giving peers feedback is, you know, I did take a course on supervision and evaluation of instruction, but I don't remember really them going into, you know, how often should you get into classrooms? What type of feedback should you give? It wasn't until I started looking into the Principal Center with Justin Bader and learning more yeah. about that tool that I started learning about, you know, this is a, you want to see, you know, the whole practice of a teacher that lies beneath the iceberg, right? And then the more you get into classrooms, the more you see that and having those conversations, not necessarily just based on their teaching, but also outside of the classroom and building that trust as well. So how do you see our teacher evaluation system shifting, or maybe how it's already shifted in your state of Washington?
It hasn't shifted in our state. In our state, really, you're required to use some version of Marzano, Danielson, or there's another one called Cell 5D. And so it's tough right now. And I think there's been a big, really since the 1983 report, A Nation at Risk, there's been an increased and seemingly ever-increasing movement that if we just create more accountability, that will create better teaching and learning. And I think that's what's ended up resulting in this. And really, if we look back at Danielson at the beginning, she didn't create it to be an evaluation model for principals to use on teachers. She created it for teachers for their own self-growth. And then somewhere along the way, it morphed. And then Marzano's same thing. It became a model. I don't think it has changed yet, but I think that there is what we're doing now, like I said at the beginning with that research, it's not working. So if it's not working, then why not make a change? And if we know teachers at all, why do we get into it? We get into it because we want to make a difference in the lives of young people. And so if we think that the best way to help them and support their improvement and growth is by rating them, when we see O'Leary's research says that works the opposite way, then let's stop doing that. And let's realize that teachers have huge hearts, and it's such a vulnerable process to be observed, to having someone come in, mm-hmm. pull out a laptop and watch you do your job. And then to just put it down to all these elements, and no one would argue that any of these elements aren't great elements in and of themselves or indicators of good teaching, but you don't have to have all of those to be good teaching, and teaching will always be craft and art. And one of the things about trust-based observations is because you're in classes so frequently, you get to see who's really, really good at what. And as part of seeing who's really, really good at what, you see there's all kinds of different ways that you can be amazing. And so if what we're doing isn't working, then I'm calling for a change. Like, let's ditch that and let's change the whole process, because what's happening isn't working. So, or at least let's do some big research studies on trust-based observations to see if that has a bigger effect on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked a little bit in the pre-chat as well about that dog and pony show, because when we only go into classrooms twice a year or something, and the teacher knows we're coming, right? They're going to put on the show. We're going to have that pre-observation chat. So we're going through the lesson already. So we kind of know what to expect. And, you know, we're looking for all those elements on the rubric during that one observation that semester. And, you know, we're not necessarily going to see all those elements. So whatever the tool is that we're using to evaluate, if we have multiple evidence points to gather from, then we'll be able to, you know, evaluate them a lot more effectively.
I agree completely. I mean, one of the things that I hear teachers say now, and it's sad to me, is they'll say the principal came in and said everything was really great in the observation, but I didn't see this one area of pedagogy. So next time, can you make sure to do that so I can check it off? And it's like, this is supposed to be about improved teaching and learning. Mm-hmm. So let's put 100% of our efforts into that instead of something that is not really functionally fun or productive for either one of us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit also about eliminating the pedagogy rating in the teacher evaluation system and replacing it with mindset. So what are some maybe rubric questions that would go along with mindset that could go into rubrics now?
What I would say instead of talking about the rubric is maybe setting it up so we're developing growth mindset and just through the whole process of it. And so TBO, Trust-Based Observations, in its effort to do that, connects professional development directly to the teacher observation evaluation process. And so research also says that anytime we have more than 10 areas that we're looking for, principals start to, or observers start to lose the forest through the trees and don't see the teaching going on because they're looking to check things off. And so on the trust-based form, there's only 9 areas. And so basically we've got professional development communities that we have for those 9 areas that will run every year, and they're led by teacher leaders. But then we do have a rubric for the template, but it's for teachers to use. And so the teachers get to do that and then rate themselves. And then with that, they choose an action research big goal related to some area of pedagogy that they want to improve. And then they tie an action research plan to it. And then they do that, they participate in that professional development community all year. So just the act of doing that, choosing a goal and choosing to work on it. And then one of the other questions that we've added to the observation reflexive conversation conference is, tell me how things are going with your action research goal this year. And so because we're constantly putting that in teachers' mind and we're letting them choose, really just that built into the process alone builds a proficient mindset. And then because we're empowering teachers at the same time, because they're participating in facilitating these conferences and even leading them, and maybe I learned something new this year and I become really excited about it, then maybe I can lead it the next year. All of that is really empowering teachers and increasing teacher efficacy. And those all just in and of themselves develop a growth mindset. And so you'd have to be really, really, really resistant mm-hmm. to not end up with proficient in that in mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the more we're able to you develop teachers to be leaders, right? To either want to be willing to share what they do in the classroom to other staff members in their building, or put on professional development at conferences, or, you know, help lead book club discussions, those type of things. It's developing leaders. It's bringing out the best of what our teachers are doing in the building, which a lot of these tools that have been used in districts for many years they have a professional growth area, right? But there's not really that, like, what are you doing to grow, right, as a leader, except for going to a couple of conferences and doing the passive listening, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what are you doing to actually support that growth along the way? And so we built it into the process, and it's differentiated because teachers generally get to choose. Now, sometimes there might be a teacher where we strongly encourage them to go in one area because that's necessary if someone were on an action plan, but it does empower them, and then they'll be more willing to take risks and grow their practice. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. What are ways you see a teacher showing evidence of growth this year, especially if they're teaching only in a remote setting, and looking outside the limits of whatever the evaluation tool principals are using this year?
And for sure, that's a really good question. And it's a really tough question because to look at this year like any other year is not really fair. And to look and expect the same times of growth is not really fair. And I mean, I think we could even go beyond that and say, certainly it's important to have literacy and numeracy function at a high level to help just basic success in the world. But I think we're also missing things in terms of like social emotional skills. And I would like to see us add something like that to a yearly regular assessment for all students on the grand scale of things. But if this year we're looking and talking about growth, I think we have to, I mean, each teacher has to know their own students and figure out what works best for them and learn. But I think if we could look at our social emotional growth of our students, I think that would be really, really powerful. I think potentially there's possibilities to maybe look at like the same units we did last year and compare growth, but like to expect superior growth when we're in this different setting, I'm not sure that's a realistic, fair expectation. In some ways, if we're just persevering and continually trying to find ways to be effective and engaging our students this year, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and maybe that's even surveys with our students, I think we're a success. And I think we can't necessarily look at down the road and say these kids are going to be behind, because I don't think they're going to be behind in the grand scheme of life. There will be things they've learned from this that will make them successful, and they're not going to be any less successful because they were in school in 2020 and 2021. Mm-hmm. I know that's not an ideal answer, but it's not really an ideal time, and I'm not sure there is an ideal answer.
Yeah, well, hopefully, you know, we'll gain a lot of knowledge from tools that we've used this year, and be able to take that back into regular classroom setting whenever that time will be for most schools, and you know, be able to rethink the evaluation tool, because I know some districts threw that out at the end of the year when everybody went remote, and some districts that are currently hybrid aren't really doing the same type of evaluation. Right. So, I mean, we don't want to put pressure on teachers this year, and like you said, it's just being in that space, if you're observing them virtually, and but also looking at you know, what they're doing to connect with their families, what they're doing to connect with students who maybe haven't showed up for those virtual meetings, and also maybe looking at what they're putting on Google Classroom, or some of the student work can also be evidence.
Yeah, and one thing I'll add to that is that just as an observer, if we can still get into classes, be it virtually or whatever, and see what teachers are doing in their classes, there's a real potential to discover some gifts, because there will be teachers that will be doing some amazing new innovative things in their classroom. And if we're in our classes as frequently as we are, we'll discover those. And then when we discover those, we can use that to have that teacher help empower their other teachers by sharing what they're doing with other teachers. And then many of those things, as you sort of alluded to, have the potential to moving in to become a regular part of practice in the future as well. So I think that's another advantage to even now adopting a trust-based, getting in frequently, is seeing teachers and then finding ways to be able to help other teachers as you discover pockets of real brilliant, innovative teaching that are going on that are effective in this crazy way that we're having to do it this year.
Well, what do you envision trust-based conversations evolving to be after this year, and how would a admin team at a school go about implementing it, let's say in the fall of 21, after reading this book, or maybe having a book study with their admin team possibly in the summer, and wanting to, you know, really dig deep into this?
That's a good question. And I think there's potentially multiple ways to do it. I think the ability to, I mean, certainly, you know, not to be a sales pitch, but, you know, the plan is to provide trainings for that too, you know, on a school by school basis or district by district basis as needed. And the ability to come in and talk with people. And then in some ways, above all, to practice like we did in that supervision class, and even amongst ourselves, and put on a little mini lessons, and then practice asking and answering these questions, and learning. If we've been doing things one way, it's so tempting to want to get feedback right away. And because, I mean, really, we could look at almost any lesson. I certainly feel like I've seen many lessons where I couldn't pick out anything that they could improve, or certainly nothing that was big enough to do it. But I think it's so tempting to want to offer suggestion on something. And if we're really going to start and really realize that the best way to foster growth is creating a trusting relationship, just take a step back, observe, ask those questions, share your strengths, and leave it at that. And do that for it. And we talk about when you start trust-based observations, for at least the first three observations, don't offer any suggestions. Even if you've been doing it some other way, tell your teachers you're going to take a step back and just take a new look at it. And you're trying this new thing, and your main goal is to build trust with you so you feel safe taking risks. And so however we can get there, whether that's a training or a book and a book study and practicing amongst your own leadership team, starting there is going to be the path to building relationships that lead to teachers' sense of vulnerability reducing enough that they're more willing to embrace taking risks, being innovative and creative, trying new things.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go. Like you said at the beginning, just have those, I would say those spot checks, those short observations where you're just getting a feel for the teacher's practice, right? Resisting necessarily giving the feedback or, you know, anything that's necessarily critical. at that time.
And yep.
saving that for the relationship building once a relationship has been built. So, I really enjoyed learning more about trust-based observations. Out of everything we discussed today, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
The teachers are our most valuable resource, and that it is incumbent upon us as school leaders to value that resource and build trusting, supportive relationships so we are there for them. And when they realize that, that is when we are much more likely to see improvement and growth happen.
That's such a great quote to end with. Where can people find you online and connect with you?
Well, on Twitter, my handle is @trustbasedcraig, and I have a website, trustbased.com. I'm on LinkedIn as Craig Randall. Those would probably be the three main areas. My email is craig@trustbased.com. And so feel free to email me there as well. And I'm happy to connect with anybody and offer any support or answer any questions that I can.
Well, it was great having you on the Out of the Trenches podcast. Thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thanks, Dana. I really appreciate the opportunity. It was a fun conversation.